Hello and welcome back, everyone. This is the Wild Leather Audio Hour in its 20th installment. I am Stefan Sasse, a contributor to Tower of the Hand and the author behind The Nerdstream Era, a blog you can find between thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com. And with me, as always, is...
Sean T. Collins. I am the blogger behind All Leather Must Be Boiled at boiledleather.com, where this lovely podcast is hosted. I also cover Game of Thrones for Rolling Stone, and I co-wrote the official annotated Game of Thrones with Elio Garcia from Westeros and Anne Grohl, the editor of the series, and I do various other things. Lately, I've been writing a lot about Mad Men for Wired, for example, so I'm a busy boy, but I am happy to make time for this particular installment of the Boiled Leather Audio Hour because it's a project that's kind of close to my heart. Stefan?
Yeah, exactly. As you may or may not know, Sean a while back wrote a reading order that combines A Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons. These are the two latest books of the Song of Ice and Fire series, of course, and they came out with rather much time in between them. And so many people just wrote them as they were in their vanilla state, so to speak. They're just two books, and the characters are split between them, and many people criticized them for not leading up anywhere particularly. They were regarded as more boring than the books that came before them, and they just seemed a little bit worse than the other books, so to speak. And we both discovered that if you take them together and view them as one thematic unit, so to speak, then you get much more from them. And Sean now created a reading order in which he rearranged all the various chapters from Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons into one giant book. And if you read this one giant book, which we have both done now over 1.5 years after he published the order, because it was really a mammoth undertaking. Oh, yes. Then you see that many of this holds water, and you still find much more things that are really interesting about these two books combined, so to speak, thematically and from the flow of the story, general flow. So having this out of the way, you can find the reading order on Boiled Leather itself. I think we will also link it on the page where you find this podcast. So Sean, how did you come up with this reading order, and what were the thoughts behind it, so the making of, so to speak?
Well, you know, I was doing a reread of the entire series, and I started thinking a lot about how I was going to proceed with Feast and Dance. Not necessarily because I had already considered them two halves of one book, although that was true, and that was largely thanks to the essay that you wrote for Tower of the Hand, Stefan, where you pointed out that besides taking place at the same time, there's a lot of thematic overlap between the two of them. The main thing for me was I was thinking about how when you hit the end of Storm, there's a gap of time between reading, say, John's last chapter in The Storm of Swords and then his first chapter in A Dance with Dragons that isn't really analogous to the gap of time between those actual events in the story, because you've got an entire new book to read in between those two chapters. You have all of A Feast for Crows to get to before you pick up with John again. And for me, that was never that frustrating, because I started reading the series not long before Dance was published. I think it was probably a year and a half that I had to wait before A Dance with Dragons came out. But obviously there are people who waited over a decade just to find out what happened to John, like, the day after his final chapter in Storm. But it doesn't feel like just things that are happening right away, because you have this entire book in between them. So, you know, I was thinking to myself, well, wouldn't it be nice if you could just kind of pick up where things left off? Because after all, the beginning of Feast and the beginning of Dance, they take place at the same time, only with different characters. Because, you know, George R. R. Martin famously split the material from those two books between the characters rather than between, you know, he didn't take all of the characters halfway through and then start a new book and take them the rest of the way through. He took half of the characters basically all the way through in one book and then did it over again with the other half of the characters in the second. And I thought it would be nice to merge them in such a way that you were keeping on top of every storyline, you know, at roughly the same time. I just thought it might make for an interesting read. Not necessarily a better one. I wasn't sure. I'd never done it. So I looked around to see if this had been done before, because I just assumed with a fandom this big and this dedicated and this full of people who are willing to devote a lot of time to figuring these kinds of things out, I figured there had to be a definitive combined reading order out there already. And I discovered that there wasn't. And if you look at the post that I originally put up when I put up the combined reading order that I came up with, you know, I have a link about links to about a half dozen other possibilities. And, you know, I explained why I liked some of them and why I didn't like some of them. I thought some of them took too many liberties with the reading order. They were trying to, you know, some of them cut entire storylines they didn't like. Some of them concentrated entire storylines and sort of took them out of chronological order to get them out of the way and then proceeded with the rest of the stuff. You know, like people did that with Dorn or the Iron Islands material. Some of the reading orders that were out there, that it just wasn't entirely clear how they came up with them. It wasn't, you know, they weren't necessarily labeled in such a way that made it easy to follow or easy to rearrange things, you know, including chapter numbers and character names and all sorts of stuff like that. So I more or less just kind of hobbled together the best version that I could from the existing versions that were out there. I kind of, you know, knowing my, you know, my criteria were I want it to be, have rough chronological order. So you're pretty much going straight through all the characters until they run out of chapters in the order that things would happen. I didn't want it to be strictly chronological order, though, because Martin doesn't write in strict chronological order. You know, he'll take you to a certain point in the narrative with a certain set of characters, and then you'll backtrack a little bit to be brought up to speed with what was going on with another character. And I didn't want to move chapters around just because, let's say, you had two Tyrion chapters, you know, that took place Thursday and Friday, and then you cut back to a Cersei chapter that took place on a Wednesday. You know, I didn't want to rearrange that. At first, I also didn't want to rearrange things to preserve surprises and reveals, because it's like, well, I already read these books. I don't really need that. I've since kind of changed my tune, and I prefer the version that I came up with that does preserve the revelation that Quentin Martell has been sent by Doran Martell to, you know, recruit Daenerys for their cause, because it just kind of is more fun that way. And to me, you know, having fun makes a difference. And then that's really the only case where you're having to radically move chapters around out of order to preserve any kind of reveal. It's literally just that one case. And then I also just wanted to write it up in a way that was clear and concise, and people could see what I did and how I did it and why I did it, and they could rearrange it if they wanted. So that's kind of the story behind the reading order that I came up with. It was very much sort of crowdsourced, the refinement of it. You know, I think I went through about a dozen little changes after it was posted that
there made were eight updates of
it. Yeah, yeah, and I think it made it better. Just in terms of aesthetics, oftentimes, like, oh, wouldn't it be nice if you had all three Lannister siblings chapters in a row here, since there's no reason you don't have it. It was just kind of the order in that section was arrived at arbitrarily. So if you just rearrange it a little bit in terms of the bouncing between feast and dance, you can get Tyrion right next to Jaime and Cersei, you know, at no cost to the narrative, things like that. And it really did help. So that's the to make a long story long, that's how the combined reading order was arrived at.
Okay, the reason why we are tackling this topic today instead of 1.5 years ago when you first finished it is that now finally we both managed to read this combined reading order. Actually, I think you finished yours about half a year ago, yeah, or three quarters of a year or something like that, mm-hmm. And I finished mine only 3 weeks ago or something. So at least my memory is rather fresh, but you are the creator, so I guess yours should be very much present. And I think I want to dive into the topic by simply describing what my reading experience with it was. I have obviously reread both books separately several times before. I had two rereads of A Dance with Dragons, plus my original one, and I guess five or six for A Feast for Crows, so there were no surprises here to be found in any way.
Yeah.
And so it was for me, I expected that I was to be somehow jolted out of the experience sometimes, because I expect a chapter to be at a specific point. You know, it is not like you memorize the order in which the chapters come, but sometimes you just know that now you're making a big jump. When you watch the show, you just know that they are now cutting to another character. I hope you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And surprisingly enough, I didn't have this feeling once while reading the combined order. At times, I already said it before we started recording, at times I really totally forgot that this was supposed to be two different books mm-hmm. at one point before it. Once you get around that, you have to swap two physical copies of the books around, which is rather inconvenient.
Yeah.
I can only say it is really a great thing if you have the audiobooks, because there you can swap freely around and create the reading order in a better way, so you don't have to drag around the two physical copies.
Yeah.
Or if you are able to somehow get your hands on a non-physical copy of it, then in that case you have a really good experience out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And this feeling of a natural flow that I enjoyed with these chapters was what really impressed me. The first time it really hit me was before the chapter for Tyrion 1, because that is obviously one of the first chapters from A Dance with Dragons, and just before it in your reading order comes Cersei 1 or 2, I don't know which, in which she discovers her father is dead, and she orders the whole Tower of the Hand to be knocked down and all these secret tunnels to be revealed. And she's crying around, Tyrion is responsible, is hitting in the walls right now, or else he's in Highgarden. And then cut, you are with the Tyrion chapter.
Yeah.
And that is just a so much more natural flow of things. It makes sense, you know. It lets you feel the power of the whole narrative. And I guess this common criticism for both A Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons, that it read like an extended road trip sometimes, especially for the Tyrion and Brienne chapters.
Mm-hmm.
They are basically crossing Westeros and Essos with no real goal in mind, and there are many descriptions of stuff that happens along the road without leading up to something in particular. This is a little bit mended in your complete reread. It is still in there, and I wouldn't miss it for the world, but many people criticize it, so right. I just thought I mentioned this. This is basically, to make a long story short this time, the natural flow of things is just what set the combined reread really apart from me. And I can only really, really say, read it this way and never again take both books as two entities and read them one after the other, but combine them and read them together.
Yeah, I don't see myself ever revisiting them separately, for sure. I got so much out of reading them together. And some of that was just revisiting the dance material with the enlightened eyes that I had after my first read-through, when I then went to Westeros.org's forums and found out about Frey pies and Theon's penis and all sorts of things like that. You know, revisiting that material with those ideas in mind was exciting and fun, because you see all that material present. And I think over time, you know, I mean, I spent a lot of that reread taking notes and copying phrases that referenced the idea that Ramsay Bolton removed Theon's genitals. You know, I mean, that's the kind of thing you can do. But that doesn't necessarily tie to reading them in tandem. What reading them in tandem does, as you say, is on the one hand, it does enhance the flow in certain areas, and it does it because you notice these things that were intended to be noticed, but maybe got obscured when the material was split in half. And I made a little list of some of these things, you know, these commonalities. And, you know, I parallels, really. And I think it's rather extraordinary. You know, one of the things that I think you pointed out is that there are a lot of questing storylines split between the two books. People on long journeys to get someplace or to find a specific person. Davos, Tyrion, Victarion, Brienne, Bran, Quentin, even, you know, to an extent, Samwell and Jaime are all on these sort of roads to nowhere. And like you, I enjoyed even the most meandering trips, like Brienne. I mean, Brienne's chapters include Septon Maribald's monologue about broken men and war, which is that's a top three favorite passage of mine from the entire series, if not number one. So I was very happy with that. But I mean, you see that this was done consciously and all these things were going on at once. You also pointed out, I believe in your original essay, that some of these storylines are about, you know, new rulers and how they sort of try and wage peace. Daenerys, Jon, and Cersei are all in that same boat.
Yep.
There's also a lot of people who are getting POV chapters who are sort of second bananas, who answer to and are defined by the monarchs to whom they are connected. Davos, Barristan, Victarion, John Connington. Also Aryo Hota, but I barely count him as a character. And I was
he's more a vehicle.
Yeah, and I was really gratified. Oh no, I'm sorry, I got confused with somebody else. But yeah, they pretty much are defined by these other people. You had a parallel that I call cruel tutelage. Arya, Sansa, and Theon are spending their chapters, you know, under the watchful eye of some of the most deadly people in the world, and what they learn about power and, you know, and how this sort of power differential affects them as people. You have, I think, five different, or maybe even six, I may have missed one, storylines about secret conspiracies to bring down a ruler. Wyman Manderly in the north, Dorne Martell in the south, those are virtually identical, those two storylines. You have Varys secretly working to undermine the Iron Throne. You have the Sons of the Harpy working to undermine Daenerys. You have the Old Pomegranate working to undermine Jon. And to a certain extent, you also have Lady Barbary Dustin Riswell working to undermine, you know, Ned still from the grave. You have a lot of characters who are confronting people who serve as the voices of the gods. Jon, Asha, Tyrion, Victarion, Bran, Cersei, Arya, Barristan, and Daenerys are all interacting with religious figures or mystical figures or people who have legitimate supernatural powers. You have supernatural people who keep popping up. Lady Stoneheart, Sir Robert Strong, Varamyr Sixskins, the Three-Eyed Crow, Coldhands, Victarion at a certain point, Melisandre. Okay. They're all living beyond their lifespans through supernatural means. You have a lot of people playing the name game. Theon, Arya, Sansa, Quentin and Quentin's friends, John Connington and John Connington's friends, Tyrion, Melisandre. They're all using aliases. You have a lot of secondary characters who use aliases, Gregor Clegane and Robert Strong, Catelyn Stark and Lady Stoneheart, Jaqen H'ghar and Pate, Mance Rayner and Rattleshirt and Abel, Cirella Sand and Alaris the Sphinx, Jane Poole and Arya Stark, Brendan Rivers and Bloodraven and the Three-Eyed Crow, Rorge and the Hound, Lem Lemoncloak and the Hound, whoever Coldhands is, it just goes on and on and on. All these, and you can't really see it until maybe you can, but putting them all together and reading all these chapters intertwined with one another, there's a thematic unity to it that belies the idea that they're just sort of random, meandering, purposeless narratives that need an editor's hand. I mean, maybe that's true. I love meandering in this world, so I don't mind. But there's a guiding intelligence behind a lot of these decisions, I think. And it was really only in, you know, I mean, I remember frantically taking notes and being so like, I can't believe, look at this, look at what was here all along. I just didn't see it before. That's exciting.
I had the same kind of revelation sometimes. One that really stuck out for me because I overlooked it frequently before was I had always stated that there is a triangle, so to speak, between Cersei, Jon, and Daenerys in the whole narrative. But there is also Asha to consider, for example, because she also tries to make peace somehow, and she has these problems with ruling, and on a much smaller scale, of course, in Deepwood Mord. And Theon provides us with the attempts of the Boltons to get peaceful land and a quiet people and stuff like that. So that's all in there. And the more natural flow of the combined reading order really helps you to get all these details. For example, when Asha turns up in the Dance with Dragons chunk of the story, it is very late in the book, obviously beyond the point where we left her in A Feast for Crows, because she was in there, so she couldn't be in the Dance with Dragons before, like Arya and Brienne and Jaime also.
Yeah.
And at that point in A Dance with Dragons, they more or less popped out, and as a reader, you know, now we have surpassed the point where A Feast for Crows ended, because on a meta level, we already knew that, at least we readers who are very active in the internet community, we knew that Martin had stated that Dance with Dragons covers a little bit more ground than A Feast for Crows does.
Yeah.
But when I had the reread order, at some point there came the first Asha chapter from A Dance with Dragons, and it didn't feel like it was, oh, there she is again, but it was just the normal flow of things, because the last time I had left her, the flight from the great thing, how did they call it, Kingsmood, it wasn't so long ago, really.
Yeah.
And there were many storylines like this. Jaime and Brienne and was the exact same thing. The distance between their last chapters from A Feast for Crows and their first in A Dance with Dragons in this reading order are just normal. It isn't such a big jump. Same is true for Victarion, for example. Not that I pretty much enjoy reading about him, but it really came as natural,
right?
In this thing. And I guess that's the second big point I have to make about this. Now that I have read it as one big work of art, of literature, so to speak. Oh man, I really say so to speak often a lot. I have to reduce this. Okay, reading this as one big book, it really gained on me. It became bigger than it was before. The sum is more than just adding two pieces together, you know?
Yeah.
And I guess this effect will become much stronger once we have read The Winds of Winter and perhaps A Dream of Spring. Because A Feast for Crows and Dance with Dragons, we really have to find a name for this thing. Dance with Crows? Feast for Crows? Don't know.
I call it Feast Dance, like Flash Dance, you know.
Ah, okay, Feast Dance. Okay, let's call it Feast Dance.
Okay.
It is pretty much the middle of the story. And like in every good drama, we have a retarding point here. Things slow down after a first climax, which obviously was the Red Wedding and the Purple Wedding and all that stuff. And you can't just keep on adding more excitement and more story developments just on top of it. That's what bad fiction does. Just getting more sensations that become increasingly empty on top of it, pile it up. So we need a new shock. So, oh, look, we killed these characters, and now we have to pop up some other minor characters that need to be constructed as masterminds or something. But Martin doesn't do that. He deliberately slows the stuff down.
Yeah.
And it may be annoying when you read it the first time, because you obviously want to know how it goes on. If you, at some point, which will hopefully come in the nearer future, we'll be able to read all the seven books as one really, really big fantasy saga, then you will, I guess, look much more benign on Feast Dance. just because it is not the anxiety and the waiting for what will happen next, but then you can appreciate what it is, what point of the story it is, and what point in the story it has to be.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I wish I could remember who pointed out, but we've now had two epilogues in the books. One took place at the end of book three, where Lady Stoneheart killed that hapless Frey, and one took place at the end of book five, when Varys returns to assassinate Kevin Lannister. And whoever this was pointed out that, well, they're epilogues because that's an act break. The end of book three is the end of act one. Yeah. The end of book five is the end of act two. So you really should see the first three books as one story and or act of a larger story, and the next two books that we just finished as the middle act, and then the final two books will be the climactic third act. And when looked at that way, the lack of resolution makes a great deal more sense. And that was another thing that I noticed in reading the two books together. The complaint was that there's no climax. You know, it kind of builds to a climax that never comes. But I think that's very deliberate. You know, when you look at, you know, I wrote a list of the POV storylines that end right at the verge of something tremendous happening. John is assassinated, and who knows what's going to happen at the Wall or with Ramsay Bolton. Kevin's assassinated, and who knows what's going to happen in King's Landing or with Sir Robert Strong. Daenerys and Drogon are facing a Dothraki horde. The combined forces of Slaver's Bay are just about to attack Meereen, and and Victarion is about to attack the combined forces of Slaver's Bay, and there's dragons out there. The trials of Cersei and Margaery are about to begin. The trial, or whatever it's going to be, of Jaime Lannister by Lady Stoneheart's about to begin. You know, you have all this business with Asha and Theon and the Iron Banker and Jane Poole about to meet Stannis, and who knows, well, I guess we sort of know how that's going to go down thanks to that preview chapter, but you certainly don't when you close Dance. Aegon is around. He's about to attack Storm's End. God only knows what's happening at Hardhome. Not all of the storylines end that dramatically, but enough of them do that I think that's, you know, you're supposed to see that as a deliberate choice. That's not an accident that, you know, you end with Darth Vader cutting Luke's hand off and saying, "I am your father." You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you're not supposed to know how that's going to go. You're just supposed to know that you're about to, all sorts of big things are about to start happening. And yeah, it's a middle act.
Yeah, it is also telling this stuff about the epilogues. I really never noticed it before. I don't know who it was to, but someone pointed that out. And we have a prologue in every book. And that is the one thing about the reading order that is a bit not nice. You can say, because you have two prologues directly following each other, but there is no second epilogue. And I remember that Martin once said that the names he gives characters in this middle act, they have different names, some of them at least. Sansa, for example, is Elaine. Arya changed his name very frequently, Cat of the Canals, and the Blind Girl. And then we have the Watcher and the Soiled Knight and what have you. And he said that there is a rhythm to it, a method, but that he won't reveal what it is. And many people have thought about it, and I would say the best we can say about it is that we don't have the information that would allow us to really give an answer about what. I think that is also very deliberate by Martin. We don't have the information. We can't decipher why he calls the chapters like he calls them, but he started it in A Feast for Crows, or in Feast Ends, let's talk about Feast Ends. Mm-hmm. He started it in Feast Ends. I don't know whether he will continue it in The Winds of Winter, but it has to have some meaning. He doesn't do that just at a whim because he thinks, oh, cool, changing the names is fun. And I think this has very much to do with the structure of all these books in acts, or at least in big chunks that need to be fewed together. It is also telling that Martin's initial plans back in 1994 or something, when he first started writing the saga, he envisioned three books. A Game of Thrones, which should cover all the stuff to the Red Wedding. I don't know what he called the second one. Was it A Dance with Dragons? I believe so. For whatever happened in between. And then the last one, Winds of Winter? I don't know.
Time for Wolves.
Time for Wolves, okay. Yeah. That would somehow provide a finale. And these three books would also match the three acts. And so I guess this really is the underlying structure of it all. And we can't really judge it, we can't really understand it before we have seen the whole thing. I mean, look at a movie like Fight Club, for example. If you you can't really judge the story before you know the big twist at the end.
It
doesn't make sense before. And I think the same is true for Feast Dance. We can't really judge how well it is, how much meandering it is, or how necessary all that stuff will become in the end. Perhaps all these informations that Tyrion provides us about the Rohan prove to be really, really important later on. We simply don't know. And I guess we are misled sometimes, because most of us really read at least the first two or three books in a row, and then had to wait a rather long time.
Yeah.
And if you try to bring yourself into a position in which you deliberately try to think you just know one book or two books, then many perspectives change. That's true, for example, for the whole John storyline, because John isn't really much of a character in the first two books. He only comes into his own in A Storm of Swords, which is, I guess, a large responsibility for why the Jon storyline sucks so much in the HBO show. Yeah. And you just forget that you aren't there yet.
Yeah.
All the time when I reread the old books, I have the Lord Commander Jon Snow, and everything leads up to it, and I know that it leads up to it. And for the show, for example, I don't know where it will lead.
Yeah.
But season three so far shows that they have a very clear vision, just like Martin did. And so when they dug themselves in on the Fist of the First Men in A Clash for Kings, and Storm of Swords was not yet out, you had no way of knowing just how this would resolve. It could be your typical, the Draenei fight the Nadir from a David Gemmell novel, but you simply couldn't know what would happen, that it all would go to smithereens like it did. And I think it is pretty much the same about Feast Dance. So we have the big problem that we don't know where it's headed. We can make assumptions. We can try to read it on our experience as readers of The Song of Ice and Fire in particular, and on a more broad level as scholars of literature, so to speak. But we can't really make a final judgment.
I agree, and I think that the best way to consider reading them together is not that it's going to magically alleviate all your concerns or answer all your questions or solve all your problems with the narrative at this stage of the narrative, so much as that it maybe removes some obstacles you might have had to enjoying things. And now don't get me wrong, like, for example, you brought up the naming convention, the shifting chapter title names that Martin introduces in these two volumes. And I spend a lot of time trying to crack that particular code to no avail whatsoever. It really doesn't work for me because it's so inconsistently applied, and pretty much any rubric you can come up with doesn't really cover all the variations. You know, Dorne and the Iron Islands, those characters, basically to a man and woman, all get shifting chapter titles, but that doesn't explain why John Connington or Barristan don't. Why they get them too, or Arya or Sansa. You can't really say that, well, the minor characters get it and the major ones don't, because that's a pretty, Theon and Arya and Sansa are all POVs going back fairly far, and they get the shifting titles. It's not even that everyone who changes their name around gets the shifting titles, because...
Yeah, Barristan, for example.
Barristan never changes his name around, and his titles shift. And Tyrion's name does shift around, and his titles don't. So, you know, I wrote a post about that, and I closed by saying, Martin has said that someday this will all make sense. And I'm willing to take him at his word, but it's a rather unsatisfying device in the meantime, and I stand by that. But the meantime is all we've got right now, and it's important not to kick against the pricks with that too much and worry that, oh, this isn't making sense. You've still got a third of the narrative left to go, basically. And this, you can't really predict where it's going now, you know, any more than you could have seen the Red Wedding coming at the end of a Game of Thrones. So don't kill yourself expecting the combined reread to solve all your problems. Expect it to enhance the flow, to maybe be, on an aesthetic level, a more enjoyable read, to help you make connections you might not have made before, to help you see unifying techniques and themes that you might not have picked up on before. That's what you should be looking at, not, well, this makes it all make sense, because it can't possibly all make sense yet. You still have two books to go.
Yeah, revisiting the question about the chapter titles once again, that's something that I really picked up during the Feast Dance read, because I had accommodated myself to these flickering titles upon the many rereads I did on the single books, and strangely enough, reading Feast Dance, they seem to pop up a little bit more. You know what I mean? They just stuck out. Just a little bit more than they did before. They seem to even make less sense than before, in a way. I don't know why this is, but the change in reading order somehow it changed the dynamic for me. So unless we know more about it, it really remains a very strange element of the books, of these two books. And I can't really place it in any kind of way.
Yeah, it's a mystery, and you can't solve these things until you have the end of the mystery to read.
Yeah, really sucks. Yeah. At a certain level. Oh man.
Yeah. Well, what can you do?
Yeah.
One thing that I wanted to discuss, because I think you can sort of. I think you can have a little more luck figuring out what is intended by it, is something that struck me very strongly upon rereading the two books in tandem like this, which I don't think had struck me at all reading them separately, and that's the sheer volume of history lessons, for want of a better word, that are dumped into the middle of chapters. Now, I wrote a post on this, and as I said in that post, I'm not really doing a comparative analysis where I'm going chapter by chapter and writing this stuff down in the other books, so maybe it's par for the course, but it sure didn't feel like that. I really felt like time after time, from character after character, you were getting a sense that the history of this world and these societies as passed down to us in the initial books is extremely unreliable and extremely bloody, and it's always been that way. And the most obvious example is when we talk about how the time frame for Westerosi history is off by potentially thousands of years. The second most obvious example are the theories that are advanced by Marwyn the Mage and Lady Barbary that the Maesters, who are recording all this history, have their own hidden agenda or agendas about magic or about the great houses, or whatever the case may be. And then there's a lot of other things that are not quite on that wow, everything you know is wrong level, but we start learning that the old gods were once worshipped with sacrifice. We start learning that grayscale is a potential pandemic with catastrophic ramifications. We learn that the legends that we've seen about Brandon the Builder or Lan the Clever or Azor Ahai, they're important, but to people, the example I have is, in Cracklaw Point or on the Sisters, they've got their own stories and their own heroes and their own legends that loom just as large for them. So I think the idea here is that, again, this sort of Game of Thrones has been played since time immemorial, and history is written by the people who win it. And it's as deeply revisionist a theme as anything else in the books, I think. The whole idea that these stories and these legends, and even this history, you know, because the Maesters do differentiate between the legends and stuff and the history. None of it, it's all kind of castles made of sand, and that is really, really fascinating and powerful and grim at this stage of the game.
Yeah, there's another thing I wanted to ask you, because I stumbled upon it in several meta commentary I read over the last few weeks and months, and many people talked about Essos more and more as, for the one hand, we got a deeper understanding about the Dance with Dragons, and on the other hand, as we delved into the HBO series. And it really is an interesting thing just how Martin depicts Essos. Because we have, on the one hand, as you said it, this very powerful thematic thing that the Game of Thrones is played everywhere. It has the same effects everywhere. And on the other hand, there has been much criticism about how Martin otherizes Essos. We have no character that is from Essos, and it is always presented at this as this kind of oriental, strange, in part savage cultures that are very very strange and alien to us. And you get the same with a more moderate degree with Dorne, where it already happens, but in Essos you get it full blown. So do you think this is also considerable, or is it more a blind eye from Martin towards the history and the cultures of other cultures than the European one?
I'm sure it's both. I think Martin's bread is buttered in European history, European medieval history, so that's why he set the novels in Westeros, and it's not in a sort of fictionalized version of any other region of the world. But no, I mean, I've always been a little bit more skeptical to the notion that Essos is uniquely depicted as either decadent or savage versus Westeros, because I think any of us can rattle off dozens, literally dozens, if not more, examples of decadent and barbarous behavior by the Westerosi. To me, I've said this a million times, the biggest difference between characters from Essos and characters from Westeros is characters from Essos sound foreign, the way they're written, their syntax, their language, their patterns of speech. They feel like foreigners, whereas Westerosi people all sound basically like fantasy versions of medieval English people. And I always kind of thought it would be neat to get a POV chapter from a character from Essos where the shoe was on the other foot, and it was the speech of Westerosi people that they encountered that sounded like too ornate or too guttural or whatever, and they just talked in regular English like the Westerosi characters talk and think in their POV chapters. I always thought that would be kind of a funny thing to flip around. But you know, most of these cities in Essos have more money than West. You know, they're in better shape in a lot of ways. The one big difference is slavery, which is a big difference. But in general, they all have achieved a fairly high level of advancement. So it's not really as clear cut as all that. But I think that the Martin has made that choice deliberately to keep Essos as a secondary concern. And, there are times when I think that's a weird choice, given how much time we're spending there, and I wonder why we don't get more POVs from Essos or any. But I do think that material is here for a reason. As you said, I think it's there to demonstrate that these kinds of conflicts exist everywhere, and they mean just as much to those people as the conflict for the Iron Throne means to the people in Westeros. And I think that's all important to keep in mind.
Yeah, that's also this thing about feast dance. It really broadens the whole point of view that not only we, but also the characters have. There are more connections between both continents. As I said, not only on a narrative level, meaning characters go there and characters also come from Essos to Westeros, like John Connington, but also implications. I mean, we have the banker from the Iron Bank of Braavos intermingling directly, involving himself directly into the conflict.
Yeah.
And perhaps even in a decisive manner, we have guys that are more cosmopolitan in a way, like Orthon Merryweather, who come into power, or Rhaen Watchers. They are all not distinctly Westerosi anymore, like the Small Council used to be, where Varys really stuck out. In the new Small Council that Cersei has assembled, Varys wouldn't stick out anymore like he did before. Even Stannis is keeping people. He sends Justin Massey to Braavos, and we have Barristan Selmy going over there, and the shockwaves from Slavish Space start reaching Westeros. We have the Cinnamon Wind making her voyage, and not only bringing characters together, but also information around and forth. And we have Marvin the Mage and Victarion goes there, and stuff like that. We have much more connection in Feast Dance than we had before. So it is not a Westerosi tale with this appendix of Daenerys anymore, but it has become a broader in scale, not in epicness necessarily, but as the big battles are done and stuff like that. But we have just broadened our view.
Yeah.
We know more about the Free Cities than we ever knew before. The Rhoyn has been introduced, Andalos. The lands that are lying around Meereen, where Daenerys is now lost in, and all this kind of stuff, the whole island of Cedars and what's there, Sotheros, all of this stuff really didn't play any role before. We knew there were summer isles just somewhere because it was Zalabaxo, but that was it basically. Yeah. And now we have more of it, and given that Martin really said that he doesn't want to do anything with it, it seems really an odd choice. It's just another of these mysteries that we will only be able to solve once we have the complete work in front of us.
Right. Well, I mean, he could just be doing it for pleasure because it's fun to do these things. But yeah, it's important to keep in mind that before Feast, we didn't know really anything about Braavos or Volantis or Meereen. And we've really gotten up-close looks at those three cities. Nothing necessarily compared to comparable locations in Westeros, simply by virtue of the fact that in each of those three locations in Essos, we really only have access to them via the POVs of one or two main characters. So you're just not going to get that sort of well-rounded perspective. That's just not the real estate. But that's really remarkable to think of, that we didn't know anything about these places before these two books. Or almost nothing about them. And now we've spent a ton of time there. We know the basic lay of the land politically. And, you know, I assume that some of that is going to come into play. Certainly, Volantis will come into play in a big way. I expect that there'll be a slave rebellion in Volantis that will provide Daenerys with the final amount of wind at her back to get to Westeros.
Yeah.
You know, I also kind of assume that she's going to meet wildling slaves who were abducted from Hardhome, who can warn her about what's going on north of the Wall. So, you know, these things will matter in that light. But, you know, I do think they serve a purpose in and of themselves as well. And it's both a narrative purpose and a thematic purpose and just an aesthetic purpose of something that Martin's clearly having fun talking about and writing about.
It's an interesting backlash from the community because I don't think it was such a big topic, this otherization of Essos, before Feast Dance came out.
Mm-hmm.
And now that we are finally spending some time there and learning something about it, people start to complain. That's strange.
Well, you know, I mean, you have
human
more
nature.
You have a greater chance to learn how unpleasant a lot of these people are. But I do And the problem, I think, is that in Westeros, we have enough POVs to see that not everybody is unpleasant. And in Essos, the preponderance of evidence exists with the assholes in these places for the most part, you know. So it's, you know, I understand the objections, even if I don't necessarily share them. I do understand them.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I have nothing more to say of you.
Me neither, man. You know, I guess I would just close by saying that at this stage, like I said before, I can't really imagine rereading them a different way anymore. I got so much out of reading them together. And I would say that if I were a new reader, I went back and forth about this for a long time. But if I were a new reader, I would recommend doing it this way too.
Me too.
You know, it's a little bit of a bummer that you won't necessarily then have a clear-cut sense of Feast and Dance as separate books and be able to weigh in that way among, you know, in discussions among the fandom. But I think that's a price worth paying, because I think so much more is revealed to you as a reader by reading them together than by reading them separately, that it's worth not being able to say, oh, I prefer, you know, to rank the five books in order, you know, as people do.
I would go even farther. I would say that Martin or Bantamdale Books and Harper White, for that matter, should really consider bringing out a new edition of these two books in a combined reading order.
Mm.
And if they do only so as an ebook, where the sheer size of it doesn't matter, because Martin cited this as a problem, the sheer amount of pages, the book would fall apart, yeah. Stuff like that. So at least as an ebook, it should be accessible to everyone in a legal way and not just in the illegal way it is now. That would be really a wish of mine, because you, as you said, you really gain so much more by reading Feast Dance than by reading A Feast for Crows and Dance with Dragons as singular entities. And it doesn't really make sense, because Martin only put them into two pieces because they were too big to be published at once.
Right.
And that is something that it really can be easily mended nowadays, because now both of them are out, so there is no publisher to consider, and no limitations of pages and stuff. And it would even have the added benefit that every one of us would certainly buy it, even if we have two single books, because we are like that. And so that's my official announcement here. Guys, please bring out Feast Dance as a
book. I'd imagine that Martin will want to revisit things, because I'm sure he feels that Feast and Dance were the way they were because they eventually were intended to be two separate books. Obviously, he did not hand them in thinking, oh, gee, this is all going to be one giant book. So he's going to have made changes that he'll want to readjust or tweak, and Lord only knows what that procedure would look like. But I agree. I think it might be nice, even if only after everything is over and they're putting out some massive box set with all the books, that might be an opportunity to revisit how those two books were split. I'm not holding my breath, but
no. It's more of wishful thinking.
Right. But yes, I think it was a worthwhile experiment to have conducted. I'm glad I did it. I'm glad you did it. I've gotten basically nothing but positive feedback from people who've tried it, both veterans of the series and people who are reading those two books for the first time. It's actually been rather overwhelming, the amount of positive feedback that reading order has gotten. So yeah, recommended, man. Recommended for sure. And I think for newcomers and old timers alike.
Okay. Then again, thanks for putting this together, and thanks for talking to with me about it. And until next time.
Yeah, it was my pleasure, and you were a big part of the inspiration for it. So thank you. And thanks. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
Bye.
Bye-bye, everyone.